BeCure Laser is now available in the UK. To get your very special offer right now, just call 0808 501 5122.
Hello and welcome to the Yes Life Show on UK Health Radio. I'm Robin Daly, host for the show and founder of the UK charity Yes to Life that's pushing the agenda for integrative medicine for people with cancer in the UK and supporting them in learning about and using integrative medicine. Thanks for joining me today. One of the more positive spin-offs of the current pandemic seems to be a rash of great new books. My guest today, Dr. Michael Dixon, a GP but also a fervent campaigner of integration, has published Time to Heal, partly an autobiography and partly an analysis of the weaknesses of medical care at present and suggestions born of raw experience for a fresh direction. Dr. Dixon has kindly made time to talk to me today from his home in Devon. Hi Michael, welcome again to the Yes to Life Show. Great to have you back.
Well, thanks very much, Robin, for inviting me.
The last time I think that you were on the show, we were actually in your GP practice in Devon that so much of your book revolves around. And I'm just wondering, knowing how many things you're involved in, I'd like to start by asking you how on earth you found time to write a book amongst it all.
Well, I think, Robin, in my late 60s, it was sort of a question of now and never. But I was fortunate because I did spend literally about 10 hours on trains before lockdown, going to London two or three times a week. And that did give me a bit of time to start putting some ideas together. And over a year, this emerged, as it were.
Right. Okay. Well, a great thing to do to collect up your thoughts from a few decades of practice and share them with everybody. I mean, more people should do it, probably.
Well, I think so, because it's a time to pause and reflect. And for me, quite a lot came from it in terms of my sort of unhappiness about the way general practice was going in some respects. In other respects, it's gone it's much more effective and safe. But the loss of the personal relationship and the loss of connection with the community, I think, is missing a trick in terms of primary care being effective and also having a satisfying life as a doctor locally, as it were.
Mm. Okay, well, look, there's a ton of things I want to talk about, having been through your book, far more than we're going to get in, I think. But anyway, let's have a go. Let's weigh in. So right at the outset, you make it clear you want to write about what's now commonly called the therapeutic relationship, something I think we both agree is being ignored to our cost in mainstream medicine for far too long. So what is it about this particular topic that drove you to want to focus in and write about it?
Well, I think because we did have these much stronger relationships in the old days, partly because we were, on 24/7, and also because we were fairly strict on terms of having personal lists and patients staying with doctors. That was a very satisfying way to work. I think it was good for patients who had someone they could call their doctor, their family doctor. But there's also a massive amount of research showing that if you have that connection, patients are more likely to be diagnosed early, they're likely to be more satisfied with their doctor, they're less likely to be prescribed medications, and their health is better. So lots and lots of research now showing that if you can create those relationships, those ongoing relationships, basically our patients get better medicine.
Interesting. So I was just going to read a quick quote from the towards the other end of the book, which says the science of medicine superseded its art. The doctor as technician, applying evidence-based medicines, replaced the doctor as healer. The most dangerous thing that a doctor can do these days in terms of his or her career is to deviate from clinical guidelines. So that in many ways summarizes the plight of modern GP practice, I think, is they're caught in this evidence-based medicine coming out of their computer and are unable to have the kind of personalized response that you're talking about and that you described so fully in the book.
Yes, I'm afraid sometimes it can almost become a tyrant. That's to say, you know, I think medicine should be about the patient and the application of science and clinical opinion, but the patient should, if you like, come first and be in the middle, and not simply, if you like, the object of that science. Because what we know about healing is that it's more than a one-to-one relationship between the pill and the patient. It has so much to do with the patient's own healing powers. You know, that mass of chemicals we have, from steroids to hormones, which keep us well normally and are an important part of healing. And therefore, we have to take into account what patients can do for themselves, their beliefs, their culture, their hopes, and also, you know, we need to take into account, in respect to being a family doctor, how the other families, other members of the family have responded to different treatments. So, you know, there's an enormous move now towards much more personalised medicine, which isn't simply applying population-based medicine to everyone in exactly the same way. And I also think it's a more subtle form of medicine, a more interesting form of medicine. It's not to say we must throw away evidence. I mean, you know, population-based evidence has, you know, meant that my patients now live to 85, 90, where they probably lived till 65 and maximum 70, you know, when I started 30, 40 years ago. However, we have missed something in terms of the care we give, particularly for those with long-term disease, particularly those with, you know, psychological issues from stress to depression, and we need to reconnect.
So we've got quantity of life, but maybe not quality.
Yes, yes, and of course, you know, for the first time ever, the actual life expectancy is not increasing.
Right.
Some people feel we may have actually got to the, you know, the end of the road in terms of how long we can keep people alive. And what I suppose surprised me during my years in general practice is how many people are alive but are not living satisfying lives, are not living happy lives or fulfilling lives. And I think medicine does have a responsibility to give people a quality of life, not simply a length of life. And with long-term diseases, almost by definition, not being curable, the important thing is that we treat the patient as well as the disease.
So your book was really a kind of investigation into the role of the GP, looking at them as both technician and healer, if you like, spreading the net rather wider than most people would view it these days to a function that was maybe quite common in the past, where they were acting as quite a central point in any community in terms of support and guidance and hope and all sorts of roles that a GP was expected to fulfil, as you clearly document in your book.
Yes, yes. I mean, we did have a wide role, and you know, even technically a wide role, because we were delivering our own babies, attending motorway accidents and farming accidents and all that sort of thing. Now I think that side of things is much better done these days by paramedics, emergency services, and the rest.
Right.
But the danger is we've lost that connection, that sort of bank account with patients, which means that you know, we know each other better, and there are ways of making up for that. And I think longer consultations, especially with patients with elderly, with people with complex problems, and there are, you know, are ways of recreating that continuity. But we have to look at the whole person, I think, Robin. You know, and the danger is that medicine will become transactional. You know, a patient comes with an aching arm, we just treat the aching arm or whatever. Whereas, you know, quite often there are so many other issues, and unless the GP is an open door to the patient won't want to mention it, they won't think he's got or she's got time, and things won't get sorted fully. And if we don't, you know, help people in that sort of wholesome way, they will continue to get symptoms and issues, and we'll never get to the root of the problem, which you know, does take time and does require a relationship.
Yeah, the backstory to the aching arm, that's the bit that's missing, yeah? Yeah.
Yes.
So, It's no surprise to me to find that you're a great writer because you're such a great public speaker, but the book's enormously readable. It's often hilarious with enticing chapters such as A Walk on the Wild Side and Sex in the Village. And it's a marvellous vehicle, I think, for enticing people into a serious lifelong pursuit of yours, putting the care back into healthcare. I'd say it's really an autobiography, tracing your early years and your family and right through your medical training. It's all portrayed with a light, humorous touch, and is leading up to your first serious encounter with the coal face, joining a GP practice in Columpton. So that was back in 1984, and you're still there nearly 40 years later. With all the much wider aims in medicine that you've pursued over the years, what's made you stick with that same role?
Well, because I think that's fundamentally what I do. I mean, though I've been involved in, you know, trying to say my bit about how the health service might be improved in general practice and various other things, particularly, as you know, complementary medicine and social prescribing, all that is predicated on being a family doctor and all the things I've learnt and therefore pursued in time have been because of that role, and that to some extent is my sort of credibility. If I talk to fellow GPs about what I think general practice could do better, you can't speak with authority if you're not doing it anymore. You're just right. This old has-been who frankly is not, you know, talking from an armchair rather than from experience. So now I need to keep that credibility, but I have to say, Robin, I really enjoy it. You know, the days I spend in general practice, I'm still endlessly full of wonder at the things that people say, the terrible problems they have to face, and the courage and humour with which they do so. For me, you know, it is it's about being part of common humanity, and I dread the day that I have to put my stethoscope on.
Yeah, well, that's all very clear from the mass of stories that are in the book. You know, having this little insight into your experience is fascinating. Really an extraordinary job. So, you know, the book's really an enormous collection of anecdotes of village life seen from your unique perspective as a GP. And, you know, you get afforded an unusual depth of insight into a neighbourhood's lives. But you've taken all these anecdotes and organised them into chapters. And in doing this, you've produced a sort of diary of a country practice. It makes for fascinating reading on its own. But your purpose in publishing it, I think, went far beyond simply passing on your observations and insights into village life. Can you expand a bit more on what you're striving to say to 21st century society?
Yes, I think it's made all the more relevant by COVID, where we've had to have physical separation, but again to recognise that personal relationships are so dreadfully important, and we know that personal relationships basically keep you alive. So I suppose I'm trying to say two things, Robin. One is about personal relationship between doctor and patient, and how important it is that we preserve the art as well as the science of that relationship, and that patients do have someone who they can call their doctor. Mm-hmm. Because often it's people come to me for advice. They come, you know, they want me to be someone with integrity, someone with a sort of fairly broad base of knowledge, but not necessarily always to discuss biomedical issues. But right. They do need somebody who they can trust. So I think that part of medicine must continue, and we must somehow find it again, because doctors are unhappy because I don't think they have it anymore, and patients are unhappy because they can't get it. And as I said before, in terms of cost economics, it doesn't actually make economic sense unless we have good, strong primary care in the traditional sense, in which general practice in this country was seen as the jewel in the crown of the NHS. So there's that one point about relationships, but the other thing I really wanted to say is I really feel that we need to make primary care and general practice in future part of public health. We need to connect the GP practice to the schools, to the local authority, to the voluntary and volunteer services, and if we do so, we can begin to start cracking these enormous nuts, like dementia, for instance, which biomedicine is not the solution.
Right.
But creating communities where, for instance, primary school children can interact with the elderly and planning rather better towns, etc., is. And then, you know, look at the young people. You know, we've got a quarter of our 14 to 16-year-old girls cutting themselves. But again, the answer is not going to be in surgery. The answer is for us to step out onto the street and to start looking at how we reconnect and remould a whole community that doesn't make people feel so dreadfully awful.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. I mean, these are massive societal problems that governments are supposed to wrestle with, and in some ways, the GP is not the place where people are looking for solutions. But as you say, there is potential for really grassroots support happening in the community that can be organised around a GP practice, as you've demonstrated, that actually maybe hold a lot more potential than some of the much flashier efforts that are being made.
Yes. I mean, you could call it barefoot public health. And then the trouble with public health is it's always been very laudable, but slightly ethereal, not necessarily connected to the average community patient or doctor or nurse, as it were. And unless we make that connection, things won't happen. And I think, especially with COVID, we've seen this. We've seen some communities like, you know, the Isle of Man and Guernsey almost escape it altogether. And others, you know, which haven't. But if we can create a much stronger, much more resilient communities with everyone working together within them and seeing, you know, their role being for each other, then I think we can be more resilient for all the things that are to come, whether it be pandemics or even climate change itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. Obviously, you've got a whole section in at the end of the book about what the lessons of COVID are, and that's such an unusual circumstance. It has given us many insights into the way we're living, which we do well to capitalise out of some of those, which is really what you're saying, I think.
Yeah, definitely. And you know, and one thing that we're having to think of locally and nationally is, you know, we've got these 750,000 volunteers nationally and lots locally. How do we maintain that ethos and, in practical terms, those volunteers post-COVID? Do we all go back to normal and say, well, that was a terrible thing, but now we can go back to normal? Or do we, and I hope we may have learned some lessons here, recognise that the way our society and communities and even our medicine was practiced was not sustainable or right, and that we need to redefine it all?
Mm-hmm. It's interesting how that mechanism, which seems to work well on individuals, which they face some enormous challenge and it makes them step back and reevaluate their life and start out in a new direction, can also apply to the whole of society.
Definitely, you know, and I think, you know, we've seen a sort of restoration of society with these volunteers, with you know, coordinators of the volunteers are themselves a voluntary, and you know, in a way, we've seen the best and the worst, haven't we? People fighting over loo rolls, but also we've seen people looking after each other.
Yes.
And I think, you know, this is a time for reckoning. You know, which side of the equation do we want to be on? We're not going to survive if we're going to fight each other.
Mm-hmm. So, two things that really jump out from the anecdotes of village doctoring are that there's a lot more to the job than antibiotics, and that things are rarely, as they appear in the textbook, symptom A needs drug B, leading to a satisfactory result C. It seems that a driving force has, however, been very hard at work to enforce the idea that it is simply a case of looking on a computer and printing out the prescription. What would you say are the motivations behind this direction of travel? What are the driving forces?
Well, standardisation, and you know, to give all of that its due, medicine and primary care is far safer, far more standardized than it used to be. And I think lives are saved and deaths are prevented. So it has had its purpose. But as I say, it's become a little bit of a tyrant. And the danger is that, you know, we've mechanized this. And I think we've sort of almost dehumanized medicine in some respects. And that has all sorts of negative effects, particularly upon the doctors, I should add. You know, I mean, it's extraordinary, isn't it, that if you ask GPs in training whether they would become doctors if they had their time again, two-thirds are now saying that they wouldn't. You know? So there's something in the current job description of a GP that is less positive than it used to be. And then if you ask patients as well, you know, do you have someone you could call your GP? Do you feel that you can get to see and to talk to someone who is there for you? Well, I'm afraid I think the answer would be less so than previously. And bearing those two things in mind, I think we need to make sure that we, you know, regain those things, because it's not simply about applying linear medicine, really.
Yeah, it's a case of not throwing out the baby with the bathwater, isn't it?
Totally.
So we've got this kind of drive towards a two-dimensional view of people and of health and happiness and well-being on the one hand, and in parallel we have the immense rise in chronic conditions that destroy lives, not least the mental conditions that you've already referred to. They start destroying lives before they've barely begun. Would you say these are two sides of the same coin?
Yes, in a way. I think the long-term disease, well, 80% of my time is spent seeing 20% of patients, many of whom have long-term disease, and of course it's increasing. The fact is that we've probably got a medical model these days that is used to treating acute medicine, you know, the acute things, rather than the long-term things. And the long-term things require a slightly different frame of mind and medicine, because, as I say, a lot of the issues are not curable, from arthritis to, you know, psoriasis, etc., etc. We can ameliorate them using our medicine, but we need to go far further than ameliorating things. We need to improve people's quality of life and function. Right. And that takes us outside of biomedicine. That's far more to do with their interests, the significance of their lives as they see it, the things that they can do, and the environment they live in, and the relationships that they have.
So you have a chapter called Relationships, in which you start to tackle the matter of the therapeutic relationship head on. And the anecdotes there tend to focus around the many occasions which simply don't fit the modern concept of healthcare. You write there, for some patients, I've come to the conclusion that a talk and a relationship is all they want. So the power of the placebo effect is illustrated over and over throughout the book, and you say, well, if we want our patients to get better, then we ignore the language of symbols, belief and imagination at our peril. Do you want to say a bit more about that?
Yes, because I think we are complex beings, we are self-organizing beings, we do have inside us an enormous amount of healing processes. You know, if you cut yourself, it heals, and if you get a cold, you get better. And so these mechanisms, if you like, the mechanisms that go with nature, are incredibly important. On the whole, in biomedicine, we challenge medicine, we contradict it with our antibiotics and our surgery and our heart attack drugs and the like, very successfully. But what we need, I think, also to do is to develop the medicine that goes with the grain of nature, that encourages our own self-healing processes, as well as the processes that enable people to help each other. Because that is not only more sort of homeostatic and therefore likely to be safer and have less side effects, but also clearly much more sustainable because it's using our own processes. You know, if you go to China, people have acupuncture. If you go to France, people, a lot of the medicines are suppositories. You know, our culture almost dictates what seems to work for us. Well, right, far more our psychology and our relationships and our history. So we need to take all these things into account and not assume, as you said earlier, Robin, that it's sort of like a billiard ball. It's one ball hits another and you get a single effect. We're not like that. We're far more complicated than that.
Right. Well, I think it's very interesting the way you distinguish between those two forms of medicine. One, if you like, that challenges, and the other one, which works with the natural momentum of things. I was very struck with, we just held our two-weekend conference, and there was so much on offer from so many different people, which all of which was really working in that way. It was actually picking up on the forces of self-healing, if you like, and supporting them, moving them into action, really increasing the momentum of self-healing, which seems a very important part of medicine, really, which is, as you say, it's not really that big a part of conventional care now.
No, I've heard great things about that weekend, and I'm sorry I couldn't come myself. But I think that is an important message, and also an important message for the younger doctors, because, you know, after 5 or 10 years in medicine, I was so frustrated because the medicine I'd learned didn't seem to fit what I was seeing in my Devon patients. They weren't using the language and the symptoms I'd learned, and neither were the solutions that I had seeming to work. And it wasn't until I've sort of got outside that box and started listening more to what people were saying and what they were saying was actually helping them that I began to realize that this isn't, you know, a sort of one-to-one thing. It's something that's fairly idiosyncratic, very personally dependent. And if you look at it, you know, if you look at medicine, the whole of modern medicine is predicated on population-based evidence. It's what the average person is helped by doing. Well, when I see a patient, there isn't an average patient. He's not that. He or she is not an average patient. It's them. And they're a sort of N equals one trial. So they are unique. And so there's this conflict between trying to see each person as like everybody else biologically and therefore the same solution. And on the other hand, that person being entirely different. And I think that the frustration for me, and to some extent for younger doctors, is the fact that we have almost abolished this N equals one medicine in favor of application of population-based evidence on everyone.
Right. Just to be clear, when you say N equals one, you mean that you're conducting a trial with only one participant?
Exactly.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's very interesting. You're right. There's this, you know, we are both things in a way. We are all human beings and we do share a common humanity and we do share many things in common. But in other ways, we're completely unique. So it's a conundrum, really.
Conundrum, and you know, clearly medicine in the old days was very much personal medicine, but not very effective. Now the pendulum swung, you know, I think too far the other way, so it's now very much impersonal medicine, but largely effective, although, as I say, life expectancy is no longer increasing, so we may be coming to the end of the journey in that direction. But of course, it needs to be a balance of both, accepting the uniqueness of the individual in terms of their hopes and aspirations and motivations, and on the other hand, accepting that there is something common biologically between us all for which the evidence fits most of us, as it were.
Okay, so now I want to ask you something about something that I feel is heavily implicated in the very poor statistics for cancer in the UK. You write that some of our patients with long-term disease seem to be the result of both the patient and their doctor renouncing hope. So, in my view, the label terminal is applied to far, far too many people with cancer, and amounts to the loss of hope that you describe. What it really says to me is that modern medicine feels helpless in the face of the circumstances, and that the choice to go for the certainty of death is an easier one to dispense than the uncertainty of reality. It gives doctors a kind of way of maintaining a position of knowing everything and being right until death, you know. And I think there's enormous power in this, as people will literally die to order when they're told they're going to die. Hope is the very stuff of life, and I think no one should ever seek to take another person's hope from them, whatever they may think. I think this is a kind of act of abuse. So, I wonder if you'd say a bit about hope and its place in the doctor-patient relationship.
Well, I think it's absolutely enormous, Robin. As you imply, we should always give people hope,
right?
Within reason, you know, being honest about it. And the fact of the matter is, even with, you know, the worst cancers, the body is still producing steroids, is still producing often antibodies against that cancer. It may not be winning, but it may still be having some effect. And what I've witnessed over the years is an extraordinary difference between people who would have, in technical terms, the same level of cancer and mm-hmm. be terminal, and how long they live. You know, I right. think of a farmer just recently who was sent home to die 5 years ago with nothing that anyone could do, and I saw him every few months, and he's still alive. He's still got, you know, palpable cancer when I examined him and everything else.
Yeah.
He's not entirely well, but, you know, these things happen. And of course, you know, especially with older people, the cancers are much slower. And cancer is becoming largely a long-term disease, isn't it, in some ways? Because,
right.
I've had so many patients who've had two or three cancers now
right.
who've got through, say, a couple of them, but and are still struggling with another. But it's part of the environment for them. It's not something that they need to necessarily have in the front of their mind all the time.
Yeah, well, it's good if that message gets around a bit more, that cancer is something that people live with, because then we don't have to do this terrible terminal thing, which is, I think it's terrible. And it is fortunate there's a group of people who immediately respond to something like a terminal diagnosis as being an assault on their hope, and they redouble their certainty of finding a way forward, and often do, against all
yeah.
the odds.
Yeah.
That's the effect it has on them.
It does, you know, and remember, you know, take prostate cancer. 80% of 80-year-olds have got prostate cancer.
Right.
So if I'm getting 80s, we've got prostate cancer. But almost very few die of it, but most people die with it. And as we get older, you know, there are more things going on in our bodies, and sometimes these are, you know, part of the aging process, and we shouldn't see them as, you know, things that are absolutely inevitably going to kill us. Prostate cancer is another interesting one, because there is so much you can do by way of diet and lifestyle,
yes.
Which we know can be effective in prolonging life. And some people, in very early stages, even possibly, you know, ameliorating or curing it. I'm not saying that you shouldn't go for the conventional options. The answer is to go for the best of both, but not to underestimate what nature's processes can do. The converse of that can sometimes itself be malignant, which I've sadly seen some people who were very ill and succumbing, where some of the relatives were saying, well, you're not trying hard enough.
No, you don't. That's bad, yeah.
Ballpark. But on the whole,
yeah.
Yes, there is hope, and there's a lot that can be done, and there's a lot to be lived for. And you've witnessed it, I'm sure, Robin.
Definitely.
Some people, where they know that they've got, a limited life expectancy, which, frankly, Paul, you all have if we look carefully enough. I mean,
yes.
All our lives are limited. Have suddenly managed to make the time they've got left perhaps the most valuable they ever had.
Yes.
Simply because there was an end point.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, Kelly Turner's work in bringing out all the factors involved in the people who kind of turned their situation around, all the things that were important to them, has been enormously important in really restoring reasonable hope to people. Okay, there's no reason why they shouldn't be one of the people who actually does survive much longer than anybody expects. And why not have a go?
Yes, yeah. Remember Penny Bron, who set up the Bristol Cancer Centre, and she had cancer everywhere for 20 years, didn't she?
Right.
Extraordinary woman, but extraordinary example.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they're not so rare as people may think, these people. I think, you know, that's certainly my experience over 15 years of Yes to Life, is that the number of extraordinary survivors, if you want to call them that, well, there's more of them than you think.
Yeah, yeah, miracles occur, and
yeah.
And you know, we should, you know, always strive to see if we can you know, defeat the things that would seek to bring us down, whether it's cancer or whether it's infection or whatever. We must never underestimate our own internal resilience.
Mm-hmm. So the chapter I alluded to at the beginning, called A Walk on the Wild Side, documents your exploration of the territory of complementary alternative medicine and your growing appreciation for its potential in supporting health and well-being. So, to most medics, it makes sound sense to keep well out of this arena, whatever they may have witnessed of its potential. So what made you open to diving in and thereby paving the way for what was to become social prescribing?
Well, I think on the negative side, it was frustration,
okay.
Depression, and dreading seeing people with things for whom I had no medical answer. You know, people with long-term tiredness at that
yes.
time, there was no answer. You just said, well, you've got mild encephalitis, now called ME, that's your diagnosis, and there's nothing we can do. So there's frustration, but also a bit of curiosity, because I rather liked the colour of many of the complementary treatments, the acupuncture, the herbal remedies and the like. They were very colourful and interesting, with a history, with an ancient wisdom attached. And the more I looked into these, the more I thought they might appeal to some of my patients. And the more I was told that they'd been helped by a chiropractor or their headaches sorted by an acupuncturist, the more I thought, well, you know, there's something here that needs to be listened to. You can't just ignore it and say, well, it's not scientific in terms of conventional medical science. If patients are getting better and they say they're getting better, surely that's something to listen up to.
Hmm. Absolutely. Well, I think that is a key point in a way, is that the tendency of science, if you like, is to observe and not to actually and to observe from a particular standpoint and not really to take a great interest in the standpoint of the patient. And when it comes to health, I mean, I like to be the ultimate arbiter as to whether I feel well or not and whether my life's going well, you know, rather than anybody else,
yeah.
you know. But that's not really allowed by science, I feel.
Well, no, I don't think we should blame science. I think our science is too limited. What we need is a science that takes those things into account.
Right.
And a real science would. But for some reason, science has been hijacked by rationalists who don't feel that these things should be included in science, which I think is wrong.
Right. Well, I would completely agree with that. Yeah, and so hence, you know, Yes to Life, our aim is to help people to do what they want to do rather than to tell them what they should be doing. It's, you know, and people will make very different decisions about what to do about exactly the same situation, apparently, on the outside. And they may both be successful as well in actually helping themselves. So it's very interesting from that point of view. So it comes back to that individualization we were talking about earlier, just how different people are.
Yeah, yeah, and people often know what's going to help them.
Yes.
There you go, you're onto a winner almost already.
Yes.
Somebody feels that something's going to be helpful.
Yes.
And, you know, that needs listening to, but it doesn't enter any care pathway I know, which says, if the patient says that might be a good idea, you should, you know, go along that care pathway. That's not part of evidence-based medicine.
No.
But it needs to be.
Interesting. Yeah. So, Yeah, maybe three quarters of the book is packed with your anecdotes, which are they're fascinating insights. They're very entertaining, and they all sort of gravitate to build a picture, if you like, which in the last quarter or so of the book, you start to analyse that and to draw conclusions from it and to make suggestions and talk about how we should respond to them. Do you want to just, you're not going to have time now, but do you want to just sort of summarise some of the main conclusions that you've come to from all of this experience?
Well, I think something about training, something about treating people and the caring professions with respect. Mm-hmm. You know, when I was training, we were fed in the mornings, we were given breakfast, we had our own car parking slots, we had a bed that you could kip in at night if you were on duty and had hours off. None of these things are now given to younger doctors. Uh-huh. My own daughter, recently as a younger doctor, had to do a pay, had to do a sort of, wasn't able to park in the hospital, had to take transport, which was always finished by the time she came off. So
Right. Something
about treating our younger doctors with respect so they like the NHS, because my generation loved the NHS, and I feel that the younger generation have been so badly treated, they don't have that positive view. So that's something at the beginning.
Okay.
I think it's something about reconnecting, allowing doctors and nurses and others to reconnect with patients. So taking away some of the bureaucracy, which thank God has gone during COVID, you know, this very weighty assessments, care quality commission, guidelines, targets, quality frameworks, all the rest, which distracts us from being able to take the patient to look after them as we want to. That needs to go. I think we need to get rid of no win, no fee. We don't want to have doctors who are more terrified of doing the wrong thing than they are wanting to do the right thing, because, you know, you talked about complementary medicine just now. You know, why should a doctor think along those lines? Because all it means is a greater risk,
more risk
of being taken to court, you know. So we need to get back to an ethos where doctors want to do their best for patients, and patients accept that from time to time, you know, they'll make mistakes, because we all do from time to time. So a bit of that. I think the continuity of care we've talked about, really important that patients have my doctor, because that is what is not only a civilised health service, but also actually a cheaper one.
I agree.
This final bit about the role of doctors in terms of bringing the community together and being part of creating a health-creating community, rather than, as we have nowadays, a community that makes us sick.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've certainly been showing the way in that, in your efforts down in Columpton. It's a bit of a bright light amongst the direction the GP practice has gone, and you've certainly, all those qualities you've sought to build in, if you like, into your practice there in very creative ways, which is inspirational. And it's also fantastic that you've sought to spread that message much wider as well through your work with the College of Medicine and elsewhere. So really very inspirational, particularly you must, I imagine, feel very proud of the way that social prescribing has sort of been like a fire that needed lighting, and it's really taken off and is meeting a need in an extraordinary way that probably neither of us would have predicted.
Yeah, totally. It has come as a shock at me, actually, Robin, because they used to call me the vicar locally, you know, and now it's a national policy. But in a sense, it's common sense, because, you know, it is our relationships, what we do, the meaning in our lives, having something to get up for, having a roof over our heads, being fed, all these things matter greatly as far as our mental and physical health are concerned. But maybe we're just coming back to recognise that.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, look, we're just about to finish, but I just want to finish with a quote from you, if I may. Towards the end of the book, you put, 40 years of my profession has taught me a great many things. I've learned that first and foremost, medicine is not about anatomy, physiology, care pathways, or always finding an evidence base. It's about people, how they are, how they feel, what they believe, and their hopes. It's about our common humanity. It's also about a doctor's place in a community, having the time to get to know and to understand an individual as well as understand the community in which they live. So I think that really sums up your message in so many ways. I think it's a great and timely book. I love the way you've capitalized on the coronavirus pandemic to really highlight and illustrate so much what you're saying. And I hope the book has a great impact.
Well, thank you very much, Robin, and thank you for reading it. So thanks, Robin, and speak to you soon.
Yeah, okay, bye-bye. You can find details of Dr. Dixon's book on the Yes to Life show page of the Yes to Life website. That's yestolife.org.uk. There's a link to the show page on the homepage. This book's highly recommended, and it's a compelling read. It's not long to go until Yes to Life's online dinner. It's on the 10th of December. Now, what better way to kick off the Christmas period than by meeting up online to be entertained by our patrons, Jerome Flynn of Game of Thrones and Ripper Street, and Linus Roach, star of Vikings and Homeland. Together, they're going to be hosting the event and introducing the incredible mentalist, Gerard Senny. He will do stuff you just won't be able to get your head around. As well as the amazing solo artist, band leader, composer, star of film and stage, including Genius, playing the young Einstein, and now signed up to play David Bowie in the upcoming film Stardust, Johnny Flynn. So this event is not to be missed. It's on the 10th of December, as I said, and you can get all the details and book on the Yes to Life website. That's yestolife.org.uk. Thanks for listening. I'll be back next week with another Yes to Life show here on UK Health Radio. Goodbye. Thank you.